Have you made an honest review? Jump onto fifthwrist.com and read real takes by real owners about their watches. And of course, get involved and write about what's on your wrist. Fifthwrist.com is your independent space to talk watches.
Hi, I'm Adam, Medium Watch, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host Roman, Times Roman AU, and this is the Independent Thinking Show.
Hi, Adam. So good to see you and hear your voice. It's been a while since you and I have done a recording together, but this is so exciting. I'm totally pumped.
It has been. Indeed. We've been so busy.
Yeah, no, but look, this is a cool episode. What recently happened? So the way we'll set the scene up for our listeners. So the way this happens, you were lucky enough recently to do sort of a whiz-bang holiday tour of Switzerland. I'm still not sure how you convinced your family to do that with you. And then you got to do some very cool factory visits and sort of meeting with really creative people in Switzerland. And you got sort of you got to meet some real horological stars and behind the scenes kind of geniuses, genii, whatever the proper term is. And one of those people is going to be with us today. So what this man does and what his company and companies do is absolutely amazing. So he's actually sort of this perfect guest for the podcast. So I'm totally pumped that we've got him with us. Now, always very hard to introduce our guests because they wear sort of many hats and they do cool stuff, but I will try. And so I'll apologize in advance if I forgot to mention some things because there's way too many cool stuff to mention in an introduction. But our guest today, he's a designer of horological complications and has worked for Audemars Piguet and Girard Perregaux and many other brands. He has his own brand called Vanguard that makes perhaps what I think is the most interesting tourbillon watch with this sort of amazing crown-operated time display mechanism that I've ever seen. So it's very cool. Hopefully we'll get to talk about that. He also runs a company called Timeforge that works as a consultancy operation to help design, create, and optimize watches for either makers or people who have the ideas to do things, but not necessarily the technical know-how. What a resume, and this should be a really excellent conversation ahead. He's been involved in a watch that you and I and some of our friends will be receiving shortly, so that's very exciting as well. So let's welcome Jeremy Frelichot to the podcast. Wonderful to have you join us today, Jeremy. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for having me tonight, and thank you for this beautiful introduction. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm glad to speak a bit about horology and what we do in Switzerland and at Timeforge.
It's fantastic to have you on the show. This is really exciting, and we're just so fortunate to have met because there are so many people that are doing so many interesting things, and hopefully this will shed a light on a part of the industry that many people, myself included, were not aware of because, you know, I will soon be wearing some of his fine work, and I might not have even known it.
Yeah, usually discretion is the main priority for us, but yeah, nice we speak a bit more.
We usually like to start with a wrist check. Jeremy, what are you wearing?
Tonight I'm wearing my Vanguard Tourbillon Black Hole. It's a prototype that we are testing, so I have to wear it. It's a good thing.
Fantastic. So this is not only a tourbillon, but it is one that you, I believe, assembled with your own hands?
Exactly, yeah.
Crazy. And Roman, what do you have today?
I can't follow the tourbillon black, you know, I can't follow the black hole tourbillon prototype on Jeremy's wrist. You know, what am I going to say now that's going to be nowhere near as cool? But I'll try. I'll do my best. We should actually say to our listeners, you should definitely, absolutely pause this if you're listening. Go and look up Vanguard Black Hole Tourbillon. Be amazed and then come right back. It's crazy. It's an amazing
thing. It's really cool. I've held it. It is awesome. It is real. It works. And, you know, it does something that I've never seen before. Time can flow backwards.
Yeah, it's insane. So you've held it. Main thing is you didn't drop it. So that's really good.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
It survived my photo taking.
As you can tell, I'm a bit overexcited, which is always a dangerous position to be. All right, I will concentrate again. So the watch I'm wearing on my wrist is, I thought, what do I have that's kind of innovative that might thematically flow into this podcast? So the watch I have on my wrist is an MIH watch, you know, which was created by some of the people that Jeremy has worked with at Oxen Junior. So it's the MIH, the original watch. And this is one of the early production pieces that still had, I believe, Ludwig Oechslin's hands on it and Mr. Paul Werber's hands assembling it and, you know, Christian Gaffner's hands and, you know, a few other people's hands in there. So that is my sort of gateway into this conversation, is an MIH watch. So I'm very happy with this piece. What about you, Adam?
Well, hopefully they'll wash their hands.
Maybe. What about you?
So I've got an Oechslin Jr. I have my Selina Tinta, which is a 2012 version of this watch. It's a nice moon phase. And Jeremy, have you seen, I believe, inside this watch and thought quite a lot about it? Or is this not one of the things that's been one of your updated creations?
Yep, we have seen a lot of the Oechslin Jr. watches. And we've been into those watches, into almost all of the models. And it's for us, it's very inspiring because it's always a kind of genius mechanism. Each time that we disassemble a watch from Oechslin Jr., we're like, wow, this is amazing. Because those watches are amazing when you have them on the wrist. But when you have them on the workbench, it's even more amazing.
But even though they're so amazing, there's always incremental improvements that can be made. And one of Jeremy's claims to fame is actually making incremental improvements to these watches to improve their performance and durability. So there's always even more to iterate. And what's cool is that these improvements have been made kind of quietly. The watch is actually, from what I hear, a better watch today than my watch was in 2012. Because there's been all these refinements, but they're quiet refinements that unless we have this conversation, some of us might not even know about.
Yeah, the difference is the watch that you have from 2012 is as good as the one from 2022. The difference is that now we can produce them in a more industrial way. It's less traditional, because before the watches were made piece by Ludwig or somebody else that was doing every piece on the machine. And then they were assembling all the pieces, maybe doing some small improvement during the assembly. But now we can do maybe 10 pieces at the same time on a CNC and just assemble the watch and it works. But the final watch is the work as well as the watch from 10 years ago. But it's just a bit easier to produce for the normal supplier. You don't need to have the same fineness as Ludwig had. You can give it to a supplier and say, okay, we want this piece with these tolerances, and you can produce them, and it's easier.
Definitely, and that's important because there's this goal now of having the Oechslin, of having these pieces that are not one-off custom creations, but instead produced in serial production. And it's definitely a key part of the business strategy.
Exactly.
We're all in different time zones here, but I guess we all have to keep our throats wet with something. So what are we all drinking right now? I've got a large cup of coffee from the local gas station. Jeremy?
Yeah, so it's not time for the coffee here. We're a Friday night, so it's gin and tonic.
Fantastic. And Roman, I'm guessing you're not having a gin and tonic, but...
Yes, I was just going to say, Jeremy, gin and tonic is usually what I drink on the podcast. That's kind of my drink of choice. Unfortunately, it is 7:17 a.m. where I am in Melbourne, Australia, so it's a little bit too early, you know, for a gin and tonic. Okay, unfortunately, I have a cup of tea. It's not from the local gas station, so it's possibly not as nice as Adam's coffee. It's homebrewed, but we'll see how we go.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We'll see how we go.
The gas station makes nice creations. What can I say? We've already got into some of the basics, but can you tell us about your training and your prior work, about your path from when you began your career to Timeforge?
Yeah, so I began 20 years ago. And I did an apprenticeship of watchmaker. In French, it's horloger-rabilleur. I don't know in English. It's a watchmaker that can do everything on a watch, including repairing a watch and rebuilding a missing part or something like this. And then I did a technician school to become a watch mechanism designer and to be able to design whole mechanism or movement or modules or everything that you can design in a watch. And this, I've done it in an evening training while I was working at Girard Perregaux. So my first job was Girard Perregaux, and I worked in the laboratory. So it was also a good school to learn what to do and what not to do in a watch, because in the laboratory, you have to test the watches and the mechanism. So you see all the things that you don't have to do. And when there is a problem, you say, okay, this, I will never do it again. And when you see something that is good, you say, okay, this is the good way to do it. And it's a very good school to learn how to conceive mechanism and good mechanism and a robust mechanism. And after that, I moved to the development office to be a complete watch mechanism designer for also something like 3 years. And then I had the chance to move to Audemars Piguet Renoué Papy in Lac, which is the provider of all the complication for Audemars Piguet and a lot of brands in Switzerland. And I worked there for 10 years. So I had the opportunity to work on a lot of different complications, from minute repeaters to chronograph to digital display and a lot of different things. And I also had the chance to work with Giulio Papy, who is the founder and who is a genius. He did some things that are really amazing. And yeah, it was also a very good school for me. And after that, I was like, okay, I'm at Audemars Piguet Renoué Papy. So it's, for me, it was the best place to be in the watchmaking industry. But I wanted to do something else, so there was nowhere that I could go. Yeah, there was no other...
What was your title, just for the listeners, when you finished your time at Audemars?
I was a... in English, it's a project manager and designer, something like this.
Give us the French version. It always sounds more impressive in French.
Okay, it's...
Yeah, see? The word chef needs to be in there, so... <That's
very good. laughs> Yeah, I was a chef. Yeah, and after that, so I was like, okay, I can go anywhere that is better than Audemars Piguet and Renoué Papy. It was just not possible. Yes. So I said I should do something by myself and try to do something not better as Audemars Piguet and Renoué Papy, but something that is more in the way that I want to work. And yeah, that's how we started TimeForge. And at Renoué Papy, Audemars Piguet, I had a colleague, Axel Leuenberger, who was in the same situation as me. He wanted to move and do something else, but he was like, yeah, I can't do anything better in another company. So we said, okay, maybe we should try to do something together. And that's how we left Audemars Piguet and started TimeForge 5 years ago. Yeah, shortly, this is my career.
And what is TimeForge?
So TimeForge, we are a development office. So we watch mechanism like wall movement, wall watches, or just modules, or just small part of a module. So we do pretty anything that we can do in the watch mechanism development. We also we are specialists in gears. So in watch, you have a lot of gears. And usually people in Switzerland base their gears on the standard that are 50 years old, something like this. They are good, but not as good as what we can expect from a modern watch. So we are specialists in gears and we can provide a solution for companies that want to improve their gears and their movement.
It is such an interesting, we'll get into TimeForge in a second. I was just reflecting on your journey to TimeForge, where you started and where you came back. And it's so interesting that quite a formative time was that Audemars Piguet Renoué Papy. So many independent watchmakers and people who run their own Maisons start there. There's this whole sort of generation of creators that came through that system. Everyone from, guys from Gruber Fawcy, Peter Speak, Baron, Sharpeneva, the Kronenfeld brothers. The list is almost not endless, but there's quite a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very good school for the watchmakers and for the mechanism designers.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you started with your apprenticeship, very early in your career, did you know pretty much straight away that sort of that straight watchmaking, whether it's assembly or repair or even design watches, not from Texas, but that, did you know that's pretty much not where you wanted to be? Was that a pretty quick realization for you?
No, I didn't know. For me, watches were amazing and I just wanted to assemble a watch and work on the movement and watches, and it was just my dream. But sure. When I worked at Girard Perregaux, working in the laboratory, it was just amazing. But I was thinking like, okay, I'm testing some movement. I know what to do, what not to do. So I can do it myself. And that's why I decided to move to the watch mechanism design and not just stay a watchmaker. And the good thing is when you're a watch mechanism design and when you have a background as a watchmaker, is that when you design something, then you can assemble it. So you learn a lot of things, because when you design something that is not good and you have to assemble it, you're like, okay, I will never do this again.
Are there other people that have had a similar path?
Yeah, there are a lot of watchmakers that had a similar path. And we have a lot, I had a lot of colleagues at Piguet that had quite a similar path from watchmaker to the development office. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think the only one that I could think of would be somebody like Romain Gauthier, you know, that came maybe slightly different side, but he came from engineering into watchmaking, whereas you've almost went the other way, you know, from watchmaking to engineering. Very cool. It's an amazing career path for sure.
And the best example for me was Giulio Papi, who was a watchmaker and moved to the computer to do amazing things.
And you've mentioned gears in standardization. Are you creating a new gear standard?
So basically what happened is we are working with Michel Belot, and Michel Belot is very well known in the watchmaking industry because he has worked in the watchmaking industry for longer than anybody else. So he has worked for like 55 years in the watchmaking industry. So he's retired now, but he continued to work because he likes what he does and he likes to transmit his knowledge. So 5 years ago, when we started Timeforge, we also started Vanguard, and we had to use a lot of gears in the Black Hole Tourbillon. And we said, okay, Michel, we have a problem. We have something like 30 different gears to develop, and we don't want to use the usual standard that doesn't work so well in some situation. Could you help us? I said, yeah, of course. So it was amazing because we were like, okay, we can have the standard from Michel Belot, so it would be the best movement that we can do.
Sure.
And we worked together for the Black Hole Tourbillon. And while working with him, we said, but Michel, now you are retired. There is nobody after you. Don't you want to transmit this and transmit all your knowledge and what you did? He said, yeah, of course, I'm looking for someone, but I never found the good guys to transmit my knowledge. And he also developed software to simulate the gears. And he said, I need somebody that can understand the gears and somebody that can understand what I did with my software, because there are something like 30,000 lines of codes. So he said, I need people that can understand the code, that can understand the watchmaking industry, that can understand the gears and how a watch works. And he said, yeah, maybe that's something that we can do. And he said, okay, yeah, we can try. And that's how we started to work with Michel Belot and to work on the standard of Michel Belot. So we didn't develop our own standard because we used the standard from Michel Belot that he developed during all his career.
Oh, wow. And did you create the software package based upon this standard?
Yeah, so he had this software that was, he had done it maybe 25 years ago. So it was running on MS-DOS window. It was not very user-friendly.
Wow.
And people still use it today because it's the one of the best way to simulate gears. And we said, okay, that's really cool, but we want something, we are in 2020, we want something that is a bit more user-friendly.
Yes.
And we, my colleague Axel, took all the code and recorded it in Python and made something that we can use on a web app and that is really, really user-friendly and that's, now it's a software that everybody can understand. It's really easy to say, okay, I have two gears. What's happening? You can see visually what's happening. If there are problems, what you can do to improve. If you can use some other standard and okay, you can use these gears. If you can use it to indicate something or just to transmit torque and everything is very visual. So he did an amazing job to make a new software.
I mean, that's fantastic. That transmission of knowledge, and Adam and I have spoken to other people on this podcast, and we're both kind of really inspired by that. You know, I collect horological books, you know, textbooks and technical books and just books about horology, because I think it's so important that these things get written down in, you know, in some sort of form so they don't get lost. So that's fantastic that you took this, you know, Michel's lifetime of experience and knowledge, and you've brought it, you know, forward into this century. That's fantastic. That's highly, highly commended. That's brilliant.
It's really important for the watchmaking industry because he has done so much things and we can't lose his knowledge. So we really try to learn a lot from him and to transmit this knowledge to the maximum of people that we can. So we're working for a lot of different brands in Switzerland. And each time that they have something that doesn't work with our gear, we said, okay, here is the solution. But also here we can explain why it didn't work before and what you have to do to make it work. So we really try to transmit the people, Michel's knowledge to the people, because it's so, so important. We don't want to lose 50 years of knowledge. It would be a shame.
Oh, for sure. So it sounds like there's basically, at least in this optimization business, two components, if not more. There's this piece where you've got a software tool that other people can use to run simulations and understand the properties of gear chains and where there might be friction, where there might be torque issues. And then there's another part where you're not selling software, but you're instead actually doing optimization consulting yourself, where you're digging into the problems, opening up the watch, thinking about the entire gear chain and how the components interact, and then working towards improvement. Why are watch companies hiring optimization consultants rather than using in-house teams? And what sort of projects are you working on for them?
So companies hire us because sometimes they just don't have the time to treat a problem. They have everybody has a lot of work, and sometimes they just say, okay, we need some external help. They can hire us for just for a few weeks or a few, just a specific problem to on which we can help them. Sometimes it's because they are working on a specific complication and they have never done it before, and they know that we did this complication before, so they can call us and say, okay, we have maybe a minute repeater and it's making too much noise. The gear train is making too much noise. Do you know how to help us? And we say, yeah, okay, we know why it's making noise. You have to work on the play of the pivot and the pinion, or maybe just to work on the gears, and you can give them input to help them on specific problem. Most of the time it's, yeah, when they have a complication that they've never did before, and they need some help of people that already did the complication. And we have a lot of experience with Axel, but we always have Michel. And Michel, with 50 years plus of experience, he always knows somebody that did the same mistake before and say, hey, yeah, we did it in 1965. We know how to do it now.
Fantastic.
There really is a lot of learning from the past. Yeah. So when we met, we were talking about different perpetual calendar designs, or I think contrasting the Audemars Piguet one versus the Kurt Klaus versus the Ludwig Oechtlin one. And in our discussion, what shocked me was that you pull up a bunch of patents and you've got a huge patent library in your computer. What role does IP and patents play in your work? Because there's actually more going on than just engineering.
Yeah, we have a huge collection of patents because when we want to do something new, we know that we will never do something new. Basically, it has been done before. We just need to find how the people in the past did the thing. So that's why we have a lot of different patents. It's to give us inspiration and just to find some solutions of some problems, or just to find some new way of doing a mechanism. It's a really good source of inspiration.
So it's incredible, because you also have to, I guess, navigate around the patents as well to some extent, because in some cases, they're still active, I'd imagine.
Jeremy, could I ask, are there any particular complications that you at TimeForge, or you yourself at TimeForge, specialize in? You know, so if I was a watch company and I wanted to design, let's say, I bring out a watch with a particular thing, would I think to myself, TimeForge are the experts in this, whether it's chronograph or repeater or something? Is there a particular thing that you guys do that either no one else does, or that you are known as the go-to people, if you like?
For the complication, there is no one complication, specific complication, yep. Because we've worked on a lot of different ones.
You do everything. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, fantastic. We're not expert in everything, but we've worked on 10 years at Audemars Piguet, you work on almost everything.
Sure, of course.
It's amazing,
But of course.
Most of the time, it's complication like chronograph or a minute repeater or something that is inspired by a minute repeater or inspired by a chronograph. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just take a function, a small part of a complication, and use it in another complication. Sometimes people just come to make some calculation of astronomical complication. For example, if you want to, to know the best way to display a moon phase or the movement of planets, you have to calculate the gears, and we're specialized in this kind of astronomical complication also. But we're interested by everything. So most of the time when people tell us we want to do a complication, there is two options. We already did it in the past, and we say, we know how to do it. Or we have never done it, and you say, that's so interesting, we want to do it.
Yes, for sure. It's so funny you mentioned astronomical complications. I love so I have a soft spot for watches with astronomical complications. Mm-hmm. All the way back, whether it's, very old, you know, Georges Margetts, you know, 17th century, but also more modern, you know, like Martin Braun or Christian van der Klaus, yes. Those kind of things. I love those, you know, I have a few. Yeah, big fan. So when you say astronomical complications, I'm like, ooh, I wonder what they're working on now.
Have you played a role in any, let's call them novel astronomical complications, where, you know, the watch is now in the market, but really was the first one to do this sort of a thing?
So the problem that we have is that we can't speak of the development that we did for our customer.
Yes.
So there was one amazing astronomical complication, but I'm sorry, oh, I can't tell you which one.
Yeah,
but the end is the consulting life, I understand.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry for the people listening to the podcast, but I can't tell.
So one of the watches you can talk about, I believe, is the Settimana. So yeah, the Fitz Wrist crew has designed its own Settimana that is to our own specifications. Towards the end of the design process, we actually worked with you in picking out the hands for the watch, which I thought was totally incredible, because normally, you know, you don't get to pick out the hands for a watch. But we actually worked with you on that process. Mm-hmm. But you had a fundamental role in the Settimana before we even picked out the hands. How have you enhanced the watch that we're about to wear?
So for the Settimana was a project from 2006 or 8 or something like this. It's quite an old project at Oxum Junior, and it was done in a very traditional way. And the first thing that we did when we took the project time forward is just thinking of what is the best way to produce a Settimana with a modern CNC, and how can we do to make it feasible for every producer in Switzerland? Because when you have a project that is so traditional, not everybody can do the parts and make it work. And we had to think of a way to produce the parts and making the good drawings with the good tolerances so that everybody can produce a watch. So it's the first thing that we did on this watch. And then we had to think, okay, one day they will do some customization on this watch, and we need to think of all the customization that they can do and try to think of the material of the watch that we can use to be able to do all the customization possible. So for example, for the cadran, the dial, we need to think, okay, if one day we need to do a PVD or another kind of coating of just rhodium or something like this, what is the best material that we can use? And what are the specifications of the coating that we can do? And we have to think of those parameters because we need to produce a part that can work without the coating and still work with the coating. Because if the coating is too thick, the wheel still need to turn on the coating. So there are a lot of parameters to think of when you're doing something like this. And I'm lost. What was the question?
Oh, just how have you changed our watch? So like, is the, for instance, the dial thinner or the hands thinner, so there's more room for various coatings?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we also try to improve the work of the watchmaker, because the first Settimana was, there wasn't so much room for the hands and for the mechanism inside. So we try to improve all the spaces between the parts so that the watchmaker can just put the parts together, then put the hands without looking too much and say, okay, it's working. We have no collision between the hands or something like this. So it's just to make things easier for everybody, for the producers, for the watchmaker, and to have a watch that is just better in the end.
That's fantastic. So basically, the tolerances were increased, and so it's possible to have more variability in the angle of the hands, I guess, positioned so that you don't have to worry as much about them colliding.
Yeah, from the tolerances, there is something very funny, because we met with Ludwig Oxin and said, okay, Ludwig, on your drawings, there are no tolerances, but how do you do? He said, I make the parts right. Okay, so the tolerances are plus minus zero. Okay, so Ludwig is working like this. All the parts that he does are perfect. But when you go to a supplier, you can say, okay, I want a perfect part. They need some tolerances. They need some just for the machine. The machine cannot produce something perfect. They always need some small tolerances to work and produce something that is deliverable to the customer.
And have you done anything to improve the serviceability of the watch, the repairability?
Oh, for the serviceability, with Oxum Junior, you don't have to do a lot of things because everything is so simple that anybody can disassemble it and make it work again. You can disassemble it, clean it, assemble it back, and it will work. It's just so easy that you don't have much to do to make it better.
That's all good to hear. Then I guess we can wear our watches for many years with confidence.
Jeremy, could I ask a question which is more philosophical rather than anything specific? Maybe not philosophical. You know, the processes that you go with, let's say with the Settimana, was very much looking at the watch and making it easier to be produced repeatedly in larger numbers. If I were to make a watch that was going to be a one-off piece, you know, that didn't need to make multiples, but I couldn't make it quite work, would I still come to you and you would look at it and say, you need to do this just for that one watch? Have you worked with clients that just wanted to make one or two pieces rather than a series of pieces? Is the process the same from your side of things?
For us, it's the same process because, you know what, when you can do 1,000 pieces and make them work, you know that if you do the same recipe for just one piece, it will be easy for everyone. And you just have the same recipe and people can just assemble it and it will work.
Interesting.
This is almost like the history of mass production and watchmaking because companies like IWC and in the whole American system with Hamilton brought this idea of industrial production rather than artisanal production.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's just a totally different set of considerations when you want things to be interchangeable.
And there is one thing that we try to do. It's something that seems a bit maybe silly. I don't know. But somebody told me once that when you want to do a good mechanism, it should be a robot should be able to assemble it. So it should be very easy. And when you think like this, you can just say, okay, I will put a wheel here and then another wheel that will come behind the wheel and then under the wheel and you just have to put it with three hands and you don't do this. You just have to make things simple. And it's the philosophy that Ludwig uses. Everything is simple with him. He uses the less part possible. The simplification is everywhere. And it's Oxon Junior for us. It's also a very good school to run to do some simplifications because everybody wants to do complications in the watch industry.
Yes.
But the real thing is to do simplifications.
Yes.
Simple complexity.
Exactly.
Is it a bit different than some of the complications you'd seen earlier in your career, or are they fundamentally similar?
No, everything is different. With Oxon Junior, everything is different. It's amazing. You know, the first time that I saw the moon phase, the Serene, I saw the mechanism, and I was like, there's something wrong. It's just not possible, because you have one big wheel with the moon, then you have two wheels under, and the precision is, I don't remember, but it's like 3,280 or something like this.
Yes.
And I was like, I've did a lot of calculation for moon phases, and it's just not possible. There is a mistake. And I made the calculation. I was like, no, it's right. Okay, it's perfect. And for all the project, every time we're like, no, it's not possible. It's not this simple. And yes, it is every time. Even for the annual calendar, for example, it's so easy. When you go to another company, you say, I want an annual calendar. It will be like 70 parts, something like this. And it will be complicated. And then we said, okay, we have a specific watchmaker that can do this. He has a lot of experience, you know, how to polish the function, how to make it work and everything. With Oxon Junior, you take the annual calendar, you put the wheels together, and that's it. It works. It's so amazing. Every piece is a lesson for us.
And it really benefits me as an owner. So I have an annual calendar light that I actually got from Roman. And it's fantastic because it's 40 grams and it's a sports watch and it's durable and it's an annual calendar. Whereas if there was more complexity, there would be more weight. There would be more worries about it having damage from vibrations. And so there's a real benefit to the simplicity for the owner.
Yeah, exactly. And you spoke of the repairability of the watch. With this one, you have no problem. It's, you can use it for everything that you want to do. You won't have any problem with it. It's just so amazing.
It's definitely a favorite watch of mine.
Yeah. Oh, you're making me miss it more and more, Adam. That's not helpful. I was just going to say, I can see why watch companies don't let you talk openly about what you do, Jeremy. You're killing the romance of, you know, you're sort of saying, you know, what the traditional watchmaking industry narrative is, you know, there's an old man sitting at a bench, you know, and it's a lifetime of experience to put those two things together. Whereas what you're saying is, I could make it easy enough that more than one old man can put it together at a bench.
I also like when it's just one specific guy that can do something, and you know that it's this guy that can do it. I went to Brugge a few days ago, and they were showing the guillochage.
Yes.
And I don't know if you've already seen a guillochage made by a traditional machine, but it's so amazing. And just a few people can do it. But when you see it, it's magic.
It's different.
Yeah, yeah. So there's also good things for the things that are so complicated.
Yes, I have RGM watches by Roland Murphy, and those are done by hand. And it's funny, I was in a store in New York about a week ago looking at a very famous, very expensive watch, $40,000. I wasn't going to buy it, but I was looking at it. And a minute after looking at it, I said, was that dial stamped? And the answer was yes. And, you know, having had RGMs and seen real guilloche, I just knew within a minute this was off. Yes. I'm not going to name names, but it was just funny to just have this intuition that there is something about real guilloche that is not achieved by stamped guilloche, even though it's very subtle. So this whole idea of one person assembling the watch, what's funny with the Sedemana is that Oxen Junior actually had an event this past summer where you could, as a customer, just show up and assemble the watch yourself. So apparently it's been simplified to such an extent that anyone can assemble it.
Yeah, it's... You still need to be taught by a watchmaker, but it's also easy that you can assemble it by yourself and you know that it will work. That's a good thing.
So that's an example of assembling a really simple watch with a few components, but you've also done something that's totally crazy. It's kind of a show of skill. So tell us a bit about the Black Hole Tourbillon. What makes it unique, and how does your work at TimeForge influence its design?
Yeah, so the Black Hole Tourbillon is the piece that made us leave Audemars Piguet, because we were thinking of leaving Audemars Piguet, but we didn't know what to do. And we met Thierry Fischer, who is the designer that had the idea of the Black Hole Tourbillon. And something like 10 years ago, he did a video of this concept, and had a lot of success on the internet. I think you can still find it on Vimeo, and you can find the spirit of the Black Hole Tourbillon. So basically, you have three discs that are rotating, and you can read the time on those three discs. And they are shaped like the vortex, and it represents a black hole. And on top of those three discs, you have a tourbillon that is really above the disc, and it's very poetic because with a black hole, you have, an excessive gravity or something like this, and the tourbillon has to fight against this gravity. So you have the watch with the tourbillon above the black hole. And when you think on the tourbillon, when Abraham-Louis Breguet invented the tourbillon, it was to fight the gravity. So we get back on this, and it's very poetic, I think. So we met Thierry, and we said, okay, you did this video, it was 5 years ago when we met at the time, but nobody did it in the real life in a watch. And he said, yeah, a lot of people told me that it was amazing, but nobody was to do the mechanism to move the disc and everything inside. I said, okay, and what if we can do it? He said, if you can do it, we do it together. So that's how we started with Thierry and Axel 5 years ago. And then we had one big problem, and it was that doing a tourbillon with a disc and everything moving and the mechanism, it's our work, so it's not easy, but we know how to do it. But we needed still to do some prototypes and find people that can trust us to invest in our company and help us to buy the prototypes and everything. And we met Mehmet Kohoturk, which a former banker from Geneva, and he told us, oh, your project is amazing. I can help you find people that will trust you, and you will be able to do this project and do something for this. So we said, okay, so we are four people now. And we are a team and we can do something together and say, okay, let's do it. And that's how we started 5 years ago with those three guys.
Amazing.
So could a robot assemble it?
Yeah, there are two parts that a robot could not assemble it. but it's still quite an easy movement to assemble. We try to do something that is easy to repair and that is not too complex. So there are a lot of complications in the watch, but we say the main thing should be the simplification. So also to manipulate the time, we said, okay, we want something easy. We don't want to turn the crown indefinitely. And we said, instead of turning the crown, we just have a simplification. So you put the crown forward just a step and the time will flow forward. And you put the crown backward just a step and the time will flow backwards. It was a simplification, and the spirit of this piece, it's making things easier for the user and for the watchmaker and for everyone that can take part on this watch.
It's like a countdown timer.
Yeah, you can use it as a countdown because you can go backward and forward. But if you leave the watch backward, it will act as a countdown.
Crazy.
You say it's simple, and I was reading about it, and I tried to understand. But even the way the time display discs change as well, they don't change instantaneously. You built a little sort of a delay almost into it, isn't it? That it's sort of...
Yeah, exactly. So I said previously that everything has already been done. Yeah. So we said, okay, we want something that moves the disc fast, but not too fast. And we said, okay, what is fast, but not too fast? A minute repeater. It's fast, but not too much. So we said, we can use a part of a minute repeater mechanism. So that's what we did. So on the back of the watch, you have two barrels and two gear trains. And one of the gear trains goes to a flywheel, I think, in English. So it's quite the same as a minute repeater for this part. And then from the flywheel, we go on the other side of the watch and back to the disc. And that's how we did to have something that moves not too fast. Because you can do something instantaneous, but you won't see the disc moving and it's not interesting. And making too slow is not interesting because you're like, okay, it moved a bit, not too much. And finding just the right tempo was a good challenge. And with this mechanism, we can control the speed of the disc. So it's very interesting.
I was going to ask about that because it sort of, when I looked at, I mean, I'm not a technical person at all, you know, so I'm dazzled by anything, but that looked amazing, like that movement. I thought it looked like a gouverneur, I think you call it, you know, that thing in the minute repeater to guide things. Yep. That was amazing. That, which once again sort of connects you to that, you know, I'm not going to use Frank Mueller's Master of Complications tagline, but I think that's it. It's that because Time Forge and yourself, you understand a range of complications, you can then marry the components from one or adapt the components from a minute repeater into this time display regulation, speed regulation. That's incredible. I mean, the watch is amazing, absolutely mind-blowing. So, yeah, Thank you. If the robot can't assemble it yet, it's still amazing. Oh, wow.
You're not a robot. Just teasing.
So how did you decide to create a separate brand, Vanguard, for the Black Hole Tourbillon, rather than just having everything being under Time Forge?
So we were thinking of two things. One was building a brand, Vanguard, and beside, I got it, so I don't know English, sorry. And on the other hand, we wanted to do something that a kind of office where we can work with everybody and try to continue to learn with everybody. Sure. Because when you have just a brand, people won't come to you and say, oh, you can help us for a complication of something like this. They say, okay, it's a brand, I work for them, and we leave them alone. So doing Time Forge, we had the opportunity to continue to work with a lot of different brands and a lot of different people and continue to learn from everybody and continue to transmit what we learn, what we know to the people. That's why we kept the two different companies.
Mm. That makes sense. You've got your consulting hat and then your watchmaking hat. In that way, there's less of a brand conflict or a channel conflict that's perceived. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So do you envisage the Black Hole Tourbillon? So you've got you have a prototype on your wrist now. Is it available for people to buy now? When do you envisage it will come out? You know, how many do you think you would want to make? That kind of stuff.
So we started 5 years ago and we did the first prototypes something like 2 years ago. We had a lot of delay because of the COVID, like everybody.
Of course.
And we tested the prototype for 1 year and a half before starting the production. And this year we started production and we've delivered the first pieces this year. And we want to do something like 25 pieces per year. This is the first year, so we're more like 10 pieces or something like this. But next year we'll grow to 25 pieces. And that's the goal. So yeah, it's available for the public, and it's, I encourage you to, you have to cut this. I don't find my word in English. Sorry.
That's fine.
Okay. So if our listeners want to buy one of these fine watches, roughly what does it cost at the moment?
So we have two different collections. We have the core collection, and it's something like 300,000 Swiss francs. And then you have the customization of the watches, and it's depending, the price is depending on the customization.
So more than 300,000, basically, yeah. I would assume. What sort of customizations do you offer?
Basically everything that you want. So we tried to do something like for Rex and Junior, we said, okay, we want to do something that people can customize as they wish, or that we can customize as we wish. So we said the best, we tried to find the best material to make some acrylization, to make the good decoration. We also tried to do parts that can be done in every material possible. So for example, if you want the case, you can have it in titanium. The core collection is in titanium, but you can also, we can produce it in platinum and gold and everything. And it's the same for the part inside of the watch. So if somebody said, okay, I want the main plate, I don't want in titanium, I want another material, it's possible. We can do pretty everything.
Wow. And why can't you do that normally? So, I mean, I know Rolex is not going to be very receptive if I just tell them, give me a titanium main plate. But from an engineering standpoint, is there a reason that I couldn't just ask them that crazy question?
From an engineering point, no, you can do everything. You just have to think of the function of the part that you want to change. For example, sure. I don't know if you want to, if you said the balance wheel, I want it in steel. We would say, okay, it's not a good option because there is magnetism and the density is not good and things like this. So there are always some limitation due to the function of the part. But for a lot of parts, you can do a lot of different things. You just have to think of the function and how it will act with the other parts around it.
Do you imagine that the majority of the watches you produce will be piece uniques, or that the majority will be standardized?
So for the core collection, we just do a limited series of 8 pieces. So it's a small production. And for the unique pieces, it's depending on the customer. But
at this price point, we don't always see that many piece uniques. Recently, I think Carl F. Booker created a line that offers people the opportunity to create a unique watch at a similar price point. And Oxen Jr. obviously has had its long-standing history of creating unique watches for customers that are willing to pay accordingly. But by and large, in horology, we do not see tons of companies offering people this opportunity. Is there a reason why?
Yes, there is a reason, but I can't say it on the podcast because company won't like it. if you cut from now, I can tell you, for example,
I was just going to say to listeners, if you want to know, contact Adam and I. We will make sure we'll get an answer from Jeremy off the microphone.
We're head out to Le Chat de Fonds.
Exactly. For an extra fee, right. For an extra fee and a promise to buy one of Jeremy's watches, we will let you know the secret.
Right. Perfect ideas.
Done. Jeremy, do you envisage the Black Hole Tourbillon to become sort of a platform for your future models? So would you think this would be a base and the next model might be a, you know, Black Hole Tourbillon with a chiming complication, or a Black Hole Tourbillon with something else? Or do you envisage your next watch to be, you know, a radically different complication or a radically different idea?
It would be a different idea, but we want to keep some code of the watch. We have some shape on the case, some specific things in the movement that we want to keep. So we want to do something different, but that will match with the current collection. And you can recognize the new piece. You say, okay, it's avant-garde because you see all those lines, those small details, and everything will be avant-garde.
Right. Fantastic.
What would you like to be working on in 3 years?
In 3 years?
Until the kinks are worked out of this tourbillon, and then you're on to the next adventures.
I know what I will be working on in 3 years, but I won't tell you now because it won't be a surprise the day when we will launch a new piece. But if I can work on something else, I think I would be happy to work on a planetarium or something like this, or a terrarium, and something astronomical because it's so really something that I like.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, those are always interesting watches. Many of us at Fifth Wrist love the Oxygeneer Day-Night simplified astronomical watch that is available from the brand.
It's just so interesting hearing you. Once again, you know, this is my own sort of hobby horse, these crazy astronomical complications. But hearing you talk, you know, about Ludwig Oxlin, you know, Ludwig did this whole series of watches for Ulysse Nardin back in, you know, late 90s, you know, the trilogy of time with the, you know, Copernicus and Tellurium and Astrolabium, I think is the third one. You know, it's just so interesting that, you know, that sort of fascination with time and the way time flows, not on day to day, but more on years and decades and hundreds of years in planetarium. It all connects really well. So yeah, I can see why you're interested in that. I'm very much interested in that. That's very cool. That's very cool. So, Jeremy, can I ask, what else do you do? What other interests do you have? Because I'm always interested in people who are really good at what they do and they have this job that's really intellectually fascinating, often have other hobbies and things that they do on the side, which they don't talk about, but they do equally well. So do you have any other interests outside of horology that occupy your time?
Yep, I have a lot. What I don't have is enough time. But yeah, I like to work with wood and trying to build some furniture or different things. So this is one of my hobby. But yeah, again, not enough time to spend enough time on it.
That's why we need to set the time of this podcast to flow backwards. If we had one of those, you know, black hole tourbillons, we could keep going, but the time would flow backwards.
Exactly. You can control the time.
Exactly. That's why you need that crown on the bottom of your watch to just do that. That's very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, it's funny too, because I enjoy the Kurt Klaus perpetual calendars where you can only have time flow in one direction, which is like a poetic limitation thinking about the way time works. But with black hole, time flows in both directions. And I guess with an inspiration for how you thought of your watch, there's something poetic in all this stuff.
Yeah, and controlling the time would be a dream for a lot of people, I think. So going in two directions could be so cool.
Absolutely.
We've learned a lot today about watch movement optimization. And this is an area that I think many of us probably are not even very conscious of. We benefit from it every day, but it is something that's hidden in many ways. And as you mentioned, you've got to maintain client confidentiality. Many of these innovations are really innovations that impact manufacturing and really bringing a watch into production, into serial production, rather than having small-scale artisanal production only. So this may be a starting point for many of our listeners. If we want to learn a bit more about this, are there any resources we can read or things we can read online or accounts we can follow on Instagram or elsewhere that will help us continue our education in understanding what's going on behind the scenes in our watches and to gain a better appreciation for them?
Yeah, for me, the best resource that I had those last years was with Open Movement because it's... I think it's the only one that share everything with everybody. They just say, okay, you want to do a watch? We can explain how to do it. And they say everything. They don't hide things. They don't say, yeah, on this part, we won't communicate because it's a bit confidential. Yeah, no. They just say, okay, this is how we do it. And it's so, so interesting. You can learn a lot of things with Open Movement just by opening the Step Finder 3D or just speaking with the people behind the Open Movement because they are really... They always like to speak with people to explain what they did and to transmit their knowledge. So for me, it's one of the best resources at the moment.
So Open Movement is actually going to be the topic of a future podcast of ours.
Nice.
We've got another gentleman named Roman that will be hopefully coming on this show very soon. So to help, I guess, tee up that podcast, can you tell the listeners a bit about what the Open Movement is and what it means and how it's changing the industry?
Yeah, so Open Movement is the, I think we can say it's the dream of one guy that said, okay, everybody don't want to share his knowledge. All the companies want to keep everything secret, but it's not the best way to work. We need to transmit the knowledge to the other watchmakers. We need to say why it works, why it doesn't work. And he said, the best way to do it is to create a movement and to share it with everybody. So that's the, Roman will explain it better than me, but I think it's the beginning of the project is sharing the passion for horology with the people.
That is amazing. And what does this mean for independent watchmakers?
Yeah, for independent watchmaker, it's something really amazing. But because now, if you want to do a, I don't know, for example, a small complication and you want to put it on movement, you just don't know how to do because you don't have access to the existing movement. If you buy an ETA movement, you need to make some measurement on the movement, but you don't know how they did. And you don't have the 3D. You just need to redesign everything with open movement. If you want to do a moon phase or something like this, you just say, okay, I will take open movement. I will take the main plate. Everything is available. And you just have to put your moon phase on open movement. And it's becoming so easy to add something to a movement with this one. So yeah, that's really great.
For sure. A lot of movements, though, are off patent now. I mean, watchmaking has been going on for over a century. How does this differ from a movement that has a patent that's expired?
Even when you have a movement that is in the industry for 50 years or something like this, you don't have access to the drawings or to the 3D. With open movement, you can have access to the 3D and you can measure everything on the computer and you can get all the information that you need. And that's something that you can have when you buy a movement existing in another company. You just buy the movement and that's it.
Yeah, the democratization of knowledge is really good for evolution and progress, isn't it? Just hiding it away just stops innovation for sure. That's very cool. So it's such a commendable initiative for sure.
Are you contributing to the project in any particular way?
Just a little bit by sharing knowledge with the people of Open Movement and helping them when I can. But yeah, they did an amazing work with Roman and Gelo, who did a lot of the watch mechanism design. They did some amazing thing, really.
Yeah, it is really amazing. I've seen just a plastic version of some of the components of it, and it's really cool to see something literally so transparently.
Yeah, and they show everything. When they did the model scale, it was just amazing because they said, okay, we did a model scale. Here it is. You can see how it works. And you can see that it's the same as the one-to-one model, but here it's bigger, so we can expand the thing. We can expand how the mechanism works. And it's so cool.
For sure.
Definitely. And I don't know if you're on Instagram. Many of the people at the show have Instagram accounts, although not all. And we sometimes like to recommend Instagram accounts to follow as well as your own Instagram account. Do you have a particular account?
I have a personal account, but with absolutely zero horology on it.
Fair enough.
But I follow a lot of people on Instagram that are in the industry. So I can recommend maybe Luc Monet is one of the best of the best watchmaker that I know. And with his Art Mécanique, you can follow him on Instagram. It's just amazing.
How do you spell that?
Mechanical arts in English. There is a German watchmaker named Kilian Leschnick who is doing amazing work. All those watchmakers that are passionate about their work, you need to follow them because you always learn things. It's a good resource.
Yeah, and a previous guest of the podcast, shout out to watchmaker Ruben Scoots from Australia. He did recommend Kilian as well. That's very cool. Always good to know these connections. Very good.
Definitely. Roman, do you have any to recommend?
I was actually, this is going to show how old school I am. As I mentioned before, I collect books because I find books a really tactile thing you can hold in your hand, but a really good kind of capture timestamp on where the industry is. So I'm actually going to recommend two books. One is an older book and one is a new book. So the new book is called Horological Alchemy. It's by Denis Flageolet of Debethune. And he just published a book on horology, which I just received last week. And it's really cool, really good to have just the way he describes things. It's sort of about progress in watchmaking in the 21st, sort of making sense of where we are in the watchmaking in the current sort of century. So Horological Alchemy by Denis Flageolet from Debethune. Very cool. And the other book I wasn't thinking about, but now that we talked about Renault and Papi a lot, there is an older book I think it was published by Audemars Piguet. It was called Horological Finishing and Decoration. And Julia Papi was one of the co-authors. And as far as I know, that's kind of the only book about horological decoration, horological finishing of components that's out there. And it's very picture heavy. So it's more about it describes the technique, but also shows you what a proper technique looks like. That's by Caroline Sirmier and Julia Papi. So they're going to be my recommendations. In honor of Jeremy not really being on Instagram, I'm going to refrain from Instagram recommendations. but
I'll give one. Mm-hmm. So there is a watchmaker in Japan, Jiro Katayama, JIRO.KATAYAMA, who has a brand, I guess, called Asuka Lowtech. And it just looks really interesting. He's clearly doing, you know, a lot in-house. There's complications. There's some sort of an unusual dial display. It excites me because I'm always interested in seeing people that are building new complications, new modules. And this is the sort of complicated watchmaking that I'm passionate about.
It is very cool. Yeah.
And, you know, just like the complicated watchmaking that Jeremy is doing. I mean, what crazy, amazing stuff. It's always fun to learn more about new innovations that are being brought to the market.
Definitely. Absolutely.
So as we wind down our episode, Jeremy, are there any things that you think our listeners should keep in mind as they wear their watches? What do you hope that everyone will learn from this podcast?
Oh, this is a tricky question.
I'm happy to share what I've learned.
Okay.
I think just reflecting on our conversation, Jeremy, I am thinking about the Swiss watch industry and probably other industries as well are based on sort of this pyramid of skill and talent that we don't even see. So all we see is, you know, a name on the dial or a name of the brand. But what we don't see is this sort of really pyramid of people and companies that contribute to this evolving, ever-improving process. So what my hope and what I've learned is I need to be more cognizant and pay more attention to actually understand when something new comes on the market. It's going to be one of my missions to actually try and find understanders who contributed to that process and, if possible, thank them personally or at least acknowledge their work, because I think that's really important. So that's what I've learned from today. So thank you for your work.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I guess that was one of the takeaways from my Swiss adventure. So I went to Switzerland in August and September and had a chance to meet Jeremy in person, as well as many other really skilled individuals, also Roman from the Open Movement Project. And what struck me is really how there are a series of different people that are all highly skilled, often in highly specialized areas, working together to design and build the watches that we wear. There are people that are experts in movement design. There are people that are experts in finishing and dials and hands and engraving case backs and building straps. And oftentimes there's a lot of collaboration across firms. And part of, to me at least, what made Le Chat de Fonds magical was seeing that it was a place where all these different interrelated firms came together to build excellent products with, to some extent, I guess, cross-fertilization of talent and people that have expertise like Jeremy working across brands and taking their skills to multiple places and also in turn learning from multiple places. So Jeremy, many of the people that are listening to this have not been to Le Chat de Fonds. What should they take away from seeing it? And how do you think going to Le Chat de Fonds would change people's appreciation of their investment in watches?
Fonds is a very special city because it's built around watches and around the watch industry. And everything is done for the watch industry. The urbanization, all the buildings, everything is done with the watch industry in mind. So if you come to La Chaux de Fonds, you will learn a lot of things just by working in the city and seeing all the small workshop that you can see. And just by looking on the windows and of the building, you think, yeah, it should be an apartment. Oh, no. It's a producer of dials or something like this. And there is producer of everything absolutely everywhere in the city. So there is a lot of history in the city for the watchmaking industry. Just my only recommendation would be to wait for the summer to come in La Chaux de Fonds, because in winter, it's very hard. There is a lot of snow and it's cold.
Truly fantastic place. And it has truly amazing people with all sorts of talent. Really specialized talent in ways that people probably can't even imagine.
Brilliant. Absolutely. I think that's a good note to wrap up on. Obviously, just to mention, make sure you check out and buy two of the black hole tourbillons, if possible, the custom one and the regular one, so you can compare the production. But seriously, you know, Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us for today's episode. It's been a really fascinating conversation, and it's always good to sort of, you know, leave us with thinking deeper about the watches that we love and how they get made and what makes them work better for the future. Mm-hmm. Last thing we always say is, you know, about Fifth Wrist, about us, you know, we set this up as a platform by enthusiasts and for enthusiasts. So if you wanted to join us, contribute, write reviews, or come on the podcast and have a conversation, please get in touch. Follow Fifth Wrist on Facebook and Instagram or on our website at fifthwrist.com. Follow me, I'm at TimesRomanAU. My co-host Adam is at Medium Watch, and big thanks to him for, you know, setting this conversation up and really reaching out to Jeremy and lots of other people. Our excellent guest, Jeremy Frelichou. I did wanted to try that one more time, and I'm sure I got it wrong again.
That's good.
Best way to find him. So make sure you check out the website timeforge.ch. There's some really cool stuff, cool descriptions about what Jeremy and his colleagues do. Also have a look at, on Instagram, I did look it up, Jeremy, there's time.forge. There's absolutely no posts, but you might as well join. The more followers Jeremy gets, the more likely he's to actually post something. That's called peer pressure.
Exactly.
You're all about it. So make sure you check that out. More importantly, though, definitely check out on Instagram, Vanguard Watches, at Vanguard Watches. There's some amazing posts. You'll see exactly the watch we're talking about and sort of follow the links there. Definitely well worth seeing that. It's a mind-blowing watch. Adam, thank you so much. Brilliant conversation. Brilliant guest suggestion. Jeremy, thank you again. Fantastic to spend a bit of time with you, get to know you. Everyone, thank you for joining us today. And as we always say, stay on time.
Fifth Wrist is by the community for the community. We would love you to join the crew via our group chat on Slack. Email us at contact@fifthwrist.com and join the movement.